Hello, my name is Stacey and welcome to Run With Me On This, a podcast to motivate, educate and distract you. There are two versions of this podcast, so if you're hearing music right now, you've downloaded the music version. This is perfect for those of you wanting to listen whilst you're out for a run. The music is designed to be upbeat and keep you going for the next half an hour or so. All of the songs are from independent artists, and the playlist will be available in the show notes. If you're not hearing any music, then you've chosen the beat-free version. Feel free to listen to this whilst you chill at home, on the train, or in bed. Don't worry, I'm not offended if my voice helps you fall asleep. Other than the music, both versions are exactly the same. This episode is all about alcohol, which many have described as the cause of and solution to all of life's problems. A few months ago, I went to see a show all about the history of alcohol, and I decided to copy them for the podcast. No, I'm joking. I did see the show. It was fun. It was called The Thinking Drinkers. They were talking about heroes of alcohol, highlighting certain people that had done good things whilst drinking or achieved great things because of alcohol. And so I thought I would go a little bit more in depth on the history of alcohol. How is eyeliner linked to vodka? Can vinegar and brown paper mend a broken head? And how many alcohol-free beers do you need to drink to get drunk? I'll answer these questions and so many more in this episode. So, if you're ready, why not run with me on this? And if you could walk in a straight line, please, madam. People have been making and drinking alcohol for, well, forever. Recently in Israel, they unearthed residue from a 13,000-year-old fermented drink, which was a bit like beer. And in China, they found fermented drinks of rice honey and fruits dating to 7,000 to 6,600 BCE. The earliest firm evidence of wine production dates back to 6,000 BCE in Georgia. The natives of South America produced a beer-like beverage from cassava or maize. The maize had to be chewed before fermentation in order to turn the starch into sugar. So, you know, enjoy your spit beer. This chewing technique was also used in ancient Japan to make sake from rice. The medicinal use of alcohol was mentioned in Sumerian and Egyptian texts dating back from about 21,000 BCE. But have you ever wondered where the word alcohol comes from? No, neither had I until I was researching for this episode. The first known use of the word was from 1672, but it likely derives from the Arabic word alcohol or alcohol. Now, because you can't see the words I'm saying, you might not notice that alcohol actually contains the word kohl, K-O-H-L, like the eyeliner. That's because the term originally referred to a method of manufacturing makeup, among other things. To find out the origin of alcohol, we go back to the 1st century CE and visit Alexandria in Egypt. Back then, it was a thriving city full of intellectuals and scholars. Adam Rogers wrote a book called Proof, The Science of Booze, in which he said, Alexandria is a science city. It is an academic city. There's universities and labs and the famous library. And this is where we find Maria the Jewess, sometimes known as Mary. She was a scientist, a professor and a lab operator. She was constantly trying to perform alchemy, or attempting to turn base metals into gold. During this process, the chemicals underwent distillation. And to help with this, she invented something called a double boiler, or better known nowadays as a bain-marie, which she obviously named after herself. You may have used one in science or in cooking. The vapours produced from the distilling process recondensed into a liquid. Using this process, the ancient Egyptians began to distill manganese ore to create intensely dark kohl eyeliner, which they mixed with other chemicals. The eyeliner was originally used as an antibacterial to stave off eye infections from the water of the Nile. Black under the eyes also helped protect from the harsh rays of the sun. The Egyptians noticed that the eyeliner made their eyes pop, as the kids say, and they looked absolutely fabulous, and so it soon became a must-have fashion accessory. Unfortunately, those wearing the eyeliner were exposing themselves to lead poisoning due to the contents of the makeup. Because Alexandria was such a hotbed of knowledge and trade, news of the distilling process quickly spread. The reason distilling apparatus became so popular is pretty obvious. Not only did it make lovely makeup and medicines, but it made booze, liquor, moonshine. Of course, as humans, we're always going to popularise something if it means we can go crazy and have fun. Like those guys that invented Viagra as a heart medicine. When they realised it also gave men stonking erections, they were like, ka-ching! Not only does alcohol taste good and make you feel great, it can kill bacteria and preserve food. People latched onto this pretty quickly and distilleries were popping up everywhere. A bit like they are today with those cool pop-up microbreweries. There is evidence of independent discovery of distillation apparatus in China in 25 to 2020 CE, which was likely used to make medicines and perfumes. However, the word alcohol was a kind of catch-all term for anything made using this process. When alcohol first landed on English shores, it was used to describe the makeup coal and other such powders. It wasn't used to describe the intoxicating drink until the 18th century. In Europe during the Middle Ages, beer, usually low strength, was an everyday drink for all classes and ages of people. It is widely believed that people drank beer because the water back then was just too dirty to drink. This is only partly true. Back in those days, before the Industrial Revolution, most people had access to fresh, clean water from a well or a stream. In the cities, it was more of an issue, where poor sanitation and cholera was commonplace. And on board ships, where sailors only had access to salty water, which, if drank, could actually kill them rather than hydrate them. The wine and beer at the time didn't really have enough alcohol content to kill all the bacteria. However, the boiling process involved in making the beer did kill off the germs and meant it could be stored for months without going off. Also, beer has more calories than plain water, and therefore, if you're working hard under the hot sun, a refreshing, low-alcoholic beer would provide nutrients, energy and hydration. So, I often see a regular joke on TV that here in the UK, we drink warm beer. Of course, in a pinch, I'll drink a beer at suboptimal temperature, but personally, I love a cold beer. Like me, most Brits don't like warm beer, and actually, never have. It's a myth spread by those Americans after the Second World War. Americans were used to really cold lager. However, here in the UK, we drank more ale or bitter. When the Americans were over here, they would go to the pub and have a pint of whatever the pub landlord had on tap that week. It would have been cold, but not as cold as the lager they were used to. And that's because ales and stouts are best at around 10 to 15 degrees Celsius. Lager, on the other hand, should be served at around 7 to 10 degrees to allow the hop aromas to come through. If you have the lager any colder than this, you really can't taste and appreciate it. And the modern lagers produced by big brand breweries take advantage of this fact. And it therefore doesn't matter that they don't have much flavour. These brewing companies try to promote how refreshing the beer is when it's ice cold. Because if you have it any warmer than 7 degrees, you may taste how bland their beer actually is. In the 16th century, Polish peasants drank up to 3 litres of beer per day. And in Coventry, England, the average amount of beer and ale consumed was about 17 pints per person per week, compared to about 3 pints per person today. Documents from the time mention nuns having an allowance of 6 pints of ale each day. English sailors received a ration of a gallon of beer per day, while soldiers received 2/3 of a gallon. In Denmark, the usual consumption of beer appears to have been a gallon per day for adult labourers and sailors. In the 15 to 1800s, Protestant leaders such as Martin Luther and John Calvin, the leaders of the Anglican Church, and even the Puritans did not differ substantially from the teachings of the Catholic Church. Alcohol was a gift of God and created to be used in moderation for pleasure, enjoyment, and health. The Hebrew Bible recommended giving alcoholic drinks to those who were dying or depressed so that they could forget their misery. Drunkenness, however, was viewed as a sin. Don't forget, modern beer is much stronger than the beers of the past, and while current beers are approximately 3 to 5% alcohol, the beers drunk in the past were generally around 1% and known as small beer. This means that back in the day, most people would be in a low level of inebriation, but getting blind drunk was not common at all. If drunk people did start to cause trouble, there was fear that this would lead to a change in the law prohibiting alcohol altogether, and so most societies warned sternly about the evils of heavy drinking. In ancient China, they changed the law 41 times in a 300-year period, enacting and then repealing abstinence. After too many episodes of public unrest, they eventually decided that people were better off with a bit of alcohol inside them, rather than stopping everyone from having it. As time went by, and we move into the Industrial Revolution, society's tolerance for drunkenness wore thin. Drunk workers caused too many accidents in the workplace, they had too many days off work and were altogether a liability. Therefore, a move towards moderation and abstinence became prominent in the 19th century. Between 1920 and 1933, the United States had a nationwide ban on the production, importation, transportation and sale of alcoholic drinks. Prohibition supporters were known as dries. They wanted to heal what they saw as an ill society damaged by the problems caused by alcohol. They set out to fight a battle for public morals and health. From local prohibition groups around the US, the campaign gained momentum throughout the country once the Women's Christian Temperance Union jumped on board. After 1900, it was coordinated by the Anti-Saloon League. The beer industry was not happy. Wet supporters from Catholic and German Lutheran communities were able to keep prohibitionists at bay for many years. That was until World War I came along. Suddenly, for some reason, the rich Germans were not very popular, no matter how much money they threw at the situation. It was finally made law, and in 1920, the 18th Amendment of the United States Constitution led to a nationwide ban. Not all alcohol was banned, however. Churches could still have wine for religious purposes. Nice to be a vicar, huh? And if you had alcohol in your possession before the ban, you could still drink it. You just couldn't make any new alcohol or sell or buy alcohol. Some research indicates that alcohol consumption declined substantially due to prohibition. Rates of liver cirrhosis, alcoholic psychosis, and infant mortality also declined. Prohibition's effect on the rates of crime and violence is disputed, however, with some saying that following the ban, the criminal gangs gained control of the beer and liquor supply in many cities. And the ban had actually done the opposite of what was intended, and criminal activity was worse than it had been before. It's not easy to know if the crime statistics are accurate, as they were not recorded until 1930. However, in some states of the country, homicide rates increased by up to 60%. Mobster bosses such as Al Capone and Charles Lucky Luciano were infamous for their bootlegging, but also for their violence. One of the most famous rum runners during the Prohibition was a guy called Bill McCoy. He smuggled liquor from the Bahamas to the east coast of the US. Here's a juicy bit of trivia for you. The phrase "the real McCoy" is attributed to him because he was always sure that he sold unadulterated alcohol. You could trust his stuff. The Prohibition did have some advantages as well. Before the Prohibition, bars and saloons had been places where men went to drink. During the Prohibition, with bars being redundant, the speakeasy was the place to go for a tipple. It became more socially acceptable for women to go to these secret drinking dens. Once the Prohibition was over, women continued to go to the pubs and drink with the men. Jazz music also became more popular, as this was the music being played in the speakeasies. The Great Depression led musicians such as Louis Armstrong to migrate up the country, taking the music with them from New Orleans through to Chicago and New York. It was inevitable. You couldn't keep alcohol away from people forever. And the repeal of Prohibition was accomplished with the ratification of the 21st Amendment on December 5, 1933. Under its terms, states were allowed to set their own laws for the control of alcohol. This led to some counties in America declaring themselves as dry, as they continued to prohibit the sale and consumption of alcohol. Now, some places took it a bit far with the rules and got twitchy if someone was even driving through the town with alcohol in the boot of the car, or if a delivery truck with booze in the back drove down the high street. Following two 1972 raids on Amtrak trains in Kansas and Oklahoma, which were dry states at the time, the bars on trains passing through the two states closed for the duration of the transit, but they managed to keep the alcohol on board. A 2004 survey by the National Alcohol Beverage Control Association found that more than 500 municipalities in the United States are dry, including 83 in Alaska. Moore County, Tennessee, the home county of Jack Daniel's whiskey, is a dry county, so they can't actually sell JD in the shops or restaurants there. Residents have to go to another county to get their booze. But does this mean that those dry counties are crime-free? Hardly. In some places, it's easier to get drugs than alcohol. One study showed that dry and moist counties in Kentucky had a higher rate of meth lab seizures than wet counties. There's an increasing trend for alcohol-free beer. In fact, most beer companies nowadays are producing an alcohol-free version of their popular beers. But have you ever wondered how they make beer alcohol-free? It's not, as I used to think, just beer-flavoured water. It's proper beer, brewed in the same way as normal beer, but then with the alcohol extracted. The alcohol is removed in one of two ways, reverse osmosis or distillation. In reverse osmosis, the beer is passed through a semi-permeable membrane with some pressure, and the small water and alcohol molecules pass through the membrane, but the larger molecules of colour, flavour and protein can't pass through. The brewery takes this stuff that doesn't pass through, adds some fresh water to it, a little bit of carbon dioxide for fizziness, and hey presto, you have lager without the alcohol. Low alcohol beer is not a new thing. Now remember when I mentioned small beer, the 1% stuff they were drinking back in medieval Europe? Well, this is how low alcohol beers were first produced. However, the true origin of brewing alcohol-free beer dates back to 1919 in the USA. Seeing as it was illegal to produce drinks with an alcohol content of more than 0.5% during the Prohibition, breweries put all their efforts into producing very pale ale with just 0.5% ABV. But why pick 0.5% and not say absolutely no alcohol at all? Well, that's because you can find 0.5% alcohol in freshly squeezed orange juice or a very ripe banana. Don't worry, you'd have to drink a whole truck full of orange juice before you'd get drunk from it, and I think you'd be put off drinking orange juice for life before you actually felt tipsy. So how many bottles of alcohol-free beer do you need to drink before it would be equivalent to just one bottle of standard beer? The answer is 9. So if you want to get drunk on alcohol-free beer, you may need to drink 30 or 40 bottles in the space of a few hours. You'd be spending most of your time on the toilet, and I just don't think it's worth it. Now, how many different vinegars do you have in your house? For me, I have 4. Malt vinegar, balsamic vinegar, cider vinegar, and red wine vinegar. I'm not telling you to show off. Oh, here's Stacey Four Vinegars again, telling us about her extensive vinegar collection. Many of you may not know this, but vinegar is actually produced by the same brewing process as alcohol, and the process for it is just as old. In 3000 BCE, the ancient Babylonians made vinegar from dates, figs, and beer for use in food and medicine, whilst the Greeks and Romans, of course, were making vinegar from wine. Vinegar was such a sought-after product that many noble or royal households in ancient China would have a vinegar maker as part of the household staff. Of course, during the Middle Ages, the English learned how to make malt vinegar, and now we can't eat chips without splashing it all over them. I once lived with an American girl who was horrified at seeing me put malt vinegar on my food. "That's a cleaning product," she gasped. And to be fair, she's right. Pour some vinegar onto a sheet of crumpled newspaper and you'll find nothing better for cleaning your windows. It makes them really sparkle. But boy, the house stinks like a chip shop for days. During the Industrial Revolution in the early 1800s, vinegar production increased on a massive scale. Producers found ways of reducing the fermentation time from several months to just a few weeks. This allowed the production of vinegar from pure alcohol to produce spirit vinegars. Japan also took to producing vinegar in a big way. Rice vinegar was made from leftover yeasts in the sake brewing process. It's used to help stick sushi rice together. Little did Matazemon Nakano know that when he started producing rice vinegar at his small family-run sake business back in the 1800s, that now his company, Mizcan, would be the largest vinegar producer in the world. And I know what you're thinking. How does that Japanese vinegar company affect me in my everyday life? Well, in July 2012, Premier Food sold its Sarsen's vinegar, Haywood's pickled onions and Defray's vinegar brands to Mizcan for £41 million. And then in late 2012, the Branston pickle brand was sold to Mizcan. Here's a little fact for you that I got off the Mizcan website. Did you know that we consume 4,000 tons of Haywood's pickled onions per year? You never know when that may come up in a pub quiz. Nowadays, cheap vinegar can be produced in a matter of days due to advanced methods of quick fermentation. However, if you want a nice vinegar like a balsamic, for example, you have to take your time. Although balsamic vinegar is brown, it's actually made from the reduction of concentrated juice of white grapes. The resulting syrup is then aged in wooden casks for a minimum of 12 years. The casks can be made from chestnut, cherry, oak or juniper and contribute to the resulting flavour. The very best stuff is aged for 25 years. During the maturation period, some of the vinegar will evaporate, and it is said that this is the angel's share. This term is also used in the production of whiskey and wine. Some of you may be very familiar with the nursery rhyme Jack and Jill. You know, they went up the hill. You will remember that he broke his crown and was mended with vinegar and brown paper. But why? Well, in the 18th and 19th century, vinegar and brown paper was a popular remedy for treating bruises and wounds. Brown paper isn't the same stuff we have nowadays. Back then, it was made of old rope, canvas and sacking, so it was absorbent. The sheets of paper were soaked in cider vinegar and then applied to the necessary injured area. If you've ever seen a cartoon picture of a person with a toothache and they've got a bandage tied around their head, guess what? They've got a vinegar and brown paper bandage tied to their face to try and ease the pain. I'm going to reveal something now which may shock some of you, especially if you're of the opinion that chip shop vinegar is the best vinegar there is. That delicious vinegar is in fact not vinegar. It is basically acetic acid mixed with water, flavourings and brown colouring. Because it is not brewed in the same way as vinegar, it can't be labelled vinegar or even be put in a vinegar-style bottle if it's on display in the chip shop. This substance has the irresistible name of non-brewed condiment. It's really quick and cheap to make, which is why the chip shops use it. But also because it's not brewed, it means there's no alcohol content, so it's halal. And because it's not produced by fermenting malt, it's gluten-free. Sometimes they add an onion flavour to it, so it tastes like it's been pickling the onions all day. I don't know why there hasn't been a nationwide expose about this in the newspapers. Anyway, let's move on. Have you ever wondered what moonshine is and how it's made? Why is it called moonshine anyway? Moonshine is any kind of alcohol, usually whiskey or rum, that is made in secret to avoid high taxes or outright bans on alcohol drinks. The term moonshine comes from Britain, where it originally was a verb, moonshining, that referred to any job or activity that was done late at night. Because the operators of illegal whiskey stills had to conduct their business out of sight of legal authorities, they were doing it in the woods, and they became known as moonshiners. The term became exclusively theirs. Now, whilst moonshiners are the people who actually make the alcohol, bootleggers are the smugglers who transport it and sell it. In colonial times, these distributors would conceal their product inside their tall riding boots, which is how they got their name. To make moonshine, you don't need many ingredients. You just need some cornmeal, sugar, yeast and water. Heat it all up together to make a mash and then leave it to rest for a few weeks. After that, you heat up the mash, and the alcohol evaporates off into the special apparatus called a still. Condensation causes it to become a liquid again, and then it's ready for bottling. If you put this liquid into a cask for a few years, you'd get a lovely smooth whiskey. But that's not moonshine. There's no time to age this alcohol. It goes straight out for selling as a clear, harsh-tasting alcohol with unknown alcoholic content. So, can moonshine make you blind, as so many myths and rumours would suggest? Well, it depends on the moonshine. Ordinarily, if you had a trustworthy moonshiner, you could be sure the tipple you were getting was pure ethanol, without anything else added. However, bad moonshiners may not realise that the first few cups of the distilled moonshine contained methanol. This is the nasty cousin of ethanol. It may also contain acetone and other yucky things. A good moonshiner would get rid of the first bit of liquid produced to remove these poisons from the final product. The thing about methanol, however, is that it can get you drunker quicker. So some unscrupulous characters would add methanol to their moonshine to make it more potent. Unfortunately, just 10 millilitres of methanol can damage your optic nerve and cause blindness. More than that can actually kill you. So make sure you can trust your moonshiner, or better still, stick to beer. Anyone who has drank alcohol knows all too well what happens if you drink too much of it. No matter how much of a good time you've had consuming beer, wine and the like, you will likely be regretting it the next day when the hangover kicks in. Headaches, nausea, thirst, and aversion to bright lights. Why do we keep doing this to ourselves? And why do some alcohols give worse hangovers than others? I personally have always found that vodka does not really get me very drunk and doesn't really give me much of a hangover. However, I've had bourbon once and it absolutely destroyed me. Turns out I can blame something called congeners for this. Congeners are chemical byproducts of the alcohol fermentation process and are found more prominently in dark liquor such as red wine, bourbon, brandy, whiskey and dark coloured beers. In fact, bourbon has 37 times more congeners than vodka. Sure, congeners make tasty booze, but they are essentially toxins that we're putting into our body and, subsequently, they worsen a hangover. Couple this with dehydration, not eating and staying out late, and you might as well just put duvet day for the next day in your calendar. We all have our own ideas as to how to cure a hangover. The most obvious cure is not to drink in the first place, of course. If you do drink, choose clear alcohol such as vodka, gin, rum and white wine. Remember, these have very few congeners which contribute to the hangover. Make sure you eat a good breakfast the day after drinking to keep your sugar levels up and reduce the tiredness. Get plenty of sleep and stay well hydrated by drinking plenty of water. There is, of course, the old favourite, hair of the dog, which means having an alcoholic drink to lessen the effects of the hangover. Oh, it does the trick, especially when you're on holiday, but maybe not the best idea if you've got to go to work that day. And that's it from me for this episode. Hopefully you are not overly intoxicated by all of these wonderful facts you've now learned about alcohol. Thank you for listening. Whether you're running, cycling or doing the washing up, you can follow the show on Twitter at RunWithMePod and Instagram at RunWithMeOnThis. Look out next week for the Jog On episode in your podcast feed. This will be a mini episode where I give feedback from listeners and tell you what we'll be talking about in the next episode. Bye bye for now. And remember, what I say may not always make sense, but run with me on this.